Hi,
this is Take Charge Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist, clinician assistant, and Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Listen, learn, and I hope you enjoy the show. Bye.
Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information. We give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back, welcome back. I'm here with my co-host,
Carol Peterson.
And this is Take Charge of Your Health. And we have another one of those very special interviews. That is, the understanding is so important to you and to your health and to your family's health. It's quite new and somewhat complex. So what I'm going to ask you to do, pull out your papers and pencils. You're going to be getting your master's in insulin resistance. We're speaking with Dr. Benjamin Vickman. We're going to be talking about insulin resistance and what it means. And when we talk about insulin resistance, guess what? We're talking about heart disease, elevated
blood pressure.
We're talking about 90% increase in cancers. We're talking about fatty liver disease. And we're talking about infertility, PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome. We're talking about erectile dysfunction and migraines and arthritis and stroke and dementia, body fat, and diabetes. So guess what? There's something in this whole talk for everyone. Isn't that fun? Something in this whole talk to help our families and ourselves. So, Carol, would you introduce the doctor to us, and then we get to ask questions?
Okay, so Dr. Benjamin Vickman is associate professor in the Department of Physiology and Developmental Biology at Brigham Young. And one of the exciting things here is his book, which is written for everybody. I think it probably a book of love, Why We Get Sick. He's got a unifying principle of just about everything. I'm very much enjoying your book. And so, Ben, as you asked us to call you, welcome to our show. We really appreciate having you today. Let's start out. Why the passion with insulin?
Right, right. Well, Corinne and Carol, thank you so much. I'm just delighted to be able to talk with you both. Carol, in the introduction, you mentioned that this is a unifying principle, and I'm glad that you mentioned it that way. And that is a large part of my interest in the topic. As a professor, I was teaching and still do a class about disease. It's an undergraduate course called Pathophysiology, and I was looking at it through the lens of a scientist, and because most of my training as an individual goes through, as a scientist goes through these graduate degrees and postdoctoral work, you're not getting trained to be a teacher, you're being trained to be a scientist. And so when I was tasked with also being a teacher as a new professor, I thought I would lean into my strengths however I could. And at the time, my strengths were insulin resistance. And that was it, pretty much. And so I wondered, how might I be able to bring insulin resistance into this course that I was teaching, which is exploring the different organ systems or tissues of the body and when they go wrong, or when there's diseases coming from these, when the tissues aren't working well. And at the time, I thought insulin resistance was only relevant to type 2 diabetes. And mm-hmm. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that.
Most of us think that.
That's right. That's right. And I was no exception. But I'm a little embarrassed because I think I should have been an exception. I should have known better. After all, it was something I was devoting my young life to understanding. And now that I'm not as young, but far more wise than I was before, it was, and in part because of my efforts to be a good professor and to play to my strengths, I was frankly quite amazed to see that insulin resistance was to varying degrees relevant to almost every chronic disease that we are worried about. So, Carol, to how you explained it, a unifying principle, this is sort of what's sometimes called the common soil theory or hypothesis, where if I can sort of continue that analogy a little bit, we look at health and disease as individual branches coming off a tree. And so someone has diabetes and they're trying to prune that one little branch. And on the other side of the tree, there's a branch called polycystic ovary syndrome. And they're trying to prune that particular branch. And a different branch is Alzheimer's disease. And they're trying to prune that branch. But they're all branches coming from the same tree. So let's just cut down the damn tree rather than continuing to prune at the branches that always grow back. And by that, I mean just conventional efforts. We are only ever treating the symptoms of these problems, but at their core, they all share a common metabolic derangement or defect, and that is insulin resistance. Now, I'm not so bold to say that insulin resistance is the sum of all disease. I'm not saying that, but I did want to emphasize that to some degree, insulin resistance is at least part of the origins of that disease. And then the beauty in that realization is that rather than looking at your diabetes and your PCOS and your migraines as three completely separate, distinct problems, you could, in fact, address all of them by actually addressing one thing.
Now, what we have in the United States, 88% of adults with what they call metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is defined as hypertension, elevated blood sugar, maybe diabetes, going into diabetes or diabetes, and obesity. So you have a large waist circumference. So with that as our baseline, what are we looking at in terms of all these chronic diseases?
Yes. So that's another dimension to my passion and enthusiasm for the topic, not only because of its influence in so many of these diseases, but also its prevalence, where, as you said accurately, a study published in 2019 revealed that 88%, just like you said, of adults in the United States are considered, I think in the study they said they were considered metabolically unfit because they had some of the criteria of what's called the metabolic syndrome. Now, what's so interesting about that disorder, now the metabolic syndrome, as you pointed out, is kind of a constellation of problems. Higher than normal waist circumference, well, I say normal, it is normal, but a higher than ideal waist circumference, so they're bigger around the middle than they should be, elevated blood pressure, elevated blood glucose, and then low HDL cholesterol and high triglycerides in the blood. So those two together could just be considered a type of dyslipidemia. So that constellation of disorders that we call the metabolic syndrome were once called the insulin resistance syndrome. As you look at the evolution of how we look at this constellation of problems, this cluster of issues that tend to go together, it was called the metabolic syndrome after it had previously been known as the insulin resistance syndrome. And I regret that we ever changed the name. Metabolic syndrome certainly is a sexier term because everyone loves the word metabolism in any of its forms. Mm-hmm. But insulin resistance syndrome is a far more descriptive and accurate term because it helps reveal the origin of the problem, because each of those issues that all seem somewhat distinct are in some way shaped by insulin resistance.
It's not very sexy.
No, but,
Carol.
So funny. I wrote a newsletter on insulin resistance for my employer, And as years went by with Raven and whatnot, we changed the newsletter to Metabolic Syndrome, and now I feel very embarrassed about it.
No, don't, because there's nothing sexy about insulin and insulin resistance. In fact, when I was thinking of a title for my book, I had thought, well, should I just say why you should care about insulin resistance? But then I knew the only person that would buy it would be my dad and my grandparents.
We might.
yeah. Well, then the very sort of informed few people. So the fact is, metabolic syndrome is just a much more provocative term. So I think it was wise marketing on your part. And at least you acknowledge its true origin. So I don't fault you for it. I, in fact, applaud your efforts to be clever.
Okay, I want to jump into something that opened my eyes in your book. And what I had sort of put out to the universe, it seems I'm acquainted with more and more people who are suffering from age-related deafness, as they say, and tinnitus. Mm-hmm. And you put that together with insulin resistance, to my delight, because I was thinking, how can all these people be helped, and why are we on that pathway? And I would believe they are selling hearing aids out the kazoo for all these people, and it's a very poor substitute for good hearing. It really is painful for people to be wearing hearing aids. And then tinnitus, knowing the etiology, and can we reverse this and help people with deafness and tinnitus? And is that really the age-related thing? It's all related to more and more insulin resistance.
Yes. In fact, I like that you bring that up. That was actually one of the last things I added to the book, Why We Get Sick, which is sort of my love letter or hate mail, insulin resistance. But I was unaware of that connection until I learned about a scientist who had collaborated with one of the legends in the field of understanding insulin resistance. And this particular scientist was an ear, nose, throat guy, or this physician who was a scientist because he was curious, which is the hallmark of any scientist, PhD or not. This was a physician in the Midwest. So I wish I could remember his name, but he, having himself kind of seen the light, he had his sort of, Saul-like conversion, and he saw the light of insulin resistance, and he then started characterizing a lot of his patients who were complaining of these exact problems, deafness and tinnitus. And so I know, unfortunately, no more or barely more than what he revealed, which was, at the time, there was a correlation that was so significant it could not be overlooked, that the patients with these auditory issues were significantly multiples more likely to have insulin resistance. Now, in time, and the reason I say I know only a little more than he did at the time, is because other people have taken the work that he provided and revealed that some of the cells involved in the sensation of hearing and understanding the sounds in the ear, they become insulin resistant, and they are compromised then in using blood sugar or blood glucose for energy. And so it's almost as if these cells in the body involved in hearing, they are hungry. And the lack of the compromised insulin action is resulting in compromised glucose uptake and metabolism into those cells.
Well, that's very interesting. But I want to get back closer to the beginning, because we know that insulin comes from the pancreas. At least most of us understand that. And we also have seen in our medical profession that when our blood sugar goes up, the only thing that really controls it, or that other than diet, the only is taking insulin, or standard medicine gives insulin to patients to control their blood sugar. Now, also what happens is the minute they get on insulin, they start gaining weight. And so Can you kind of give us a little sense of this and where, if you think that's the best therapy or if there are other options?
Yes, yes. So just by way of, let me give one moment of background, although I'm sure your listeners don't need this. So insulin's main action, in fact, let me be more fair to insulin, and I'll rephrase that. Insulin's most famous action, or what it is most well known for, is the control of blood glucose. So when we eat a starchy or sugary meal or snack or drink, our blood glucose levels will skyrocket. That is unhealthy. In fact, it's quite lethal if it stays too high for too long. So insulin comes in as the savior and helps lower the glucose levels from the blood by basically opening doors into certain cells, like the muscle and the fat cells, and then pushing the glucose or allowing the glucose to then be escorting the glucose from the blood into those tissues. And then all other tissues are just freely pulling in glucose as they will, most others, and they don't need insulin. But nevertheless, insulin does many, many other things than just control blood glucose levels. So that's why I say the blood glucose effect is its most famous, mm-hmm. but it's really selling insulin short because it's more than just a one-trick pony. It does hundreds, if not thousands, of different things at different cells. Literally every single cell in the body, from brain cells to bone cells and lung cells to liver cells, all of them have insulin receptors, and all of them respond to insulin in some way. So it's no surprise that insulin does so many different things, far beyond just controlling blood sugar levels. Now, as someone is progressing towards type 2 diabetes, to get more to the heart of your question, as someone's progressing towards type 2 diabetes, there's an unfortunate side effect to us looking at diabetes as a glucose problem. Because type 2 diabetes, I strongly contend, is an insulin problem. It's not a glucose or blood sugar problem. It's an insulin problem. And unfortunately, by looking at it strictly through the lens of glucose, we miss the more relevant marker, which again is insulin. So someone may be coming in for their annual visits to their doctor every year. They're gaining a little weight. Their blood pressure's starting to go up a little bit. And the glucose is normal on year one. It's normal on year two. It's a little higher on year three. And it's a little higher for the next few years. And then it's only 10 years later, once we first started noticing the general little rise in glucose. Now it's gotten to the point where we say, oop, you're a diabetic. Your fasting glucose is now sufficiently high. You've met the clinical cutoff, which is around 126 milligrams per deciliter consistently at a fasting level. Now you are diabetic. And so now let's intervene and start doing something. Unfortunately, that glucose-centric paradigm results in us totally missing what I contend is the more relevant marker, because over that decade, insulin was significantly higher, several times higher than it should have been. And if we'd been looking at insulin at year one, we would have caught the problem immediately. We would have said, okay, your glucose is still normal, but you need a lot more insulin than you used to in order to keep that glucose normal. In other words, you are insulin resistant, which is synonymous with the term pre-diabetic. Mm-hmm. And that's the tragedy. If we looked at type 2 diabetes as an insulin problem, we could detect the problem up to a decade or more before the glucose levels ever changed. And then imagine just how much more effective then it is when we start intervening before they've gone so far down the road. But nevertheless, by looking at insulin, we could detect the problem sooner and we could treat the problem better. Because when we give the type 2 diabetic insulin as a therapy to lower their glucose, that itself is reflective of our obsession with glucose and a total disregard for insulin. Because most people with type 2 diabetes already have significantly elevated insulin. There's a kind of a myth surrounding type 2 diabetes where most people will say the insulin has become insufficient to control your glucose level.
I hear that all the time.
It's a relative. It's a relative term. What it doesn't mean is, if we were more accurate, we would say your insulin is several times higher than it used to be, but you're so insulin resistant that it's just not enough to keep your glucose in control anymore. because what people mistakenly interpret that statement to be, where we say insulin is insufficient, what they think is being said, and maybe even the person saying it thinks that's what they're saying, is that your insulin is basically near zero, and thus we need to put more insulin into your system because you don't have enough. Well, they don't have enough because the pancreas can't make any more because it's already making five times more than it used to, and it's just not working. And so giving a type 2 diabetic even more insulin, it will lower their glucose, but they die faster and they get fatter than before. In fact, we know the more aggressively we treat someone with insulin who has type 2 diabetes,
right,
they are three times more likely to die from heart disease, and they're two times more likely to die from cancer. And as you said, they get significantly fatter. So giving a type 2 diabetic insulin is a wonderful way to make someone fatter and sicker than they were before, and it's because they already are swimming in a sea of insulin. They need to lower the insulin and make the body more insulin sensitive. So let the insulin work better rather than push the insulin up even higher. In fact, let me put a very fine point on this idea. Giving a type 2 diabetic insulin and hoping it will solve the problem is like giving an alcoholic another glass of wine and hoping that's going to cure their alcoholism.
That's a hard one.
So do you recommend people, if they're going in for their routine checkups, that they make sure to ask for a fasting insulin level?
I do it every time.
Is that adequate?
It is. Yes, that's a wonderful.
It's a baseline.
I would say at the very least, get your fasting insulin, and that will immediately turn the page to you now focusing in on the fundamental problem. So if someone can at least get a fasting insulin, wonderful. That's a wonderful starting point. The gold standard would be to do an oral glucose tolerance test.
Mm-hmm.
Come in and they drink their 75 grams of glucose. And then if it's possible, you look at the dynamic pattern of measuring insulin at time point zero, right before they drink it. Then 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes, 120 minutes. But even if they can't do every one of those time points because it just gets cost prohibitive, I would say measure time point zero, measure time point 120 at 2 hours. And if the insulin has gone back down to under 30, in the U.S. it'd be 30 microunits per mil, mm-hmm. then that's a good sign. That's a good sign that the person is doing all right. But at the fasting level, if they have a fasting level of insulin that's 6 microunits per mil and lower, that's wonderful. That strongly, strongly suggests they're doing great. I would say if it's anywhere less than around 15 fasting, it may be okay. They might be all right. Let's look at some other factors like their blood pressure and their glucose. And if they're higher than the high teens or 20s, I'd say that's very, very strong evidence that the person is insulin resistant. But nevertheless, if they can do a 2-hour oral glucose tolerance test and look at that pattern, if the peak of that, I'm getting very specific here, but I'll just be quick. I just can't help myself. If the peak of that pattern is at 30 minutes, so if at 30 minutes the insulin is its highest and then it comes down, at time point 60, 90, 120, that's excellent. That's a good sign. And then again, at time 120, if that insulin has gone below 30 microunits per mil, another good sign. So any deviation from that normal or the good signs would be evidence of a problem.
You know, we don't really think about this, but when we increase our insulin and we control it, with our diet,
mm-hmm.
we
mm-hmm.
control it with carbohydrates, we control it with sugar, we control it by the times we eat also. So insulin, we are very much in control of before it gets out of control. But in the buildup to severe diabetes, we control it. But even in diabetes, we can control it. But we don't really understand that when insulin goes up, our metabolic rate goes down. So here we are eating carbs and sugars, and our metabolic rate is going down. So our propensity is to gain more fat from the same amount of food that you were eating before. Because the rate has, your metabolic rate has been suppressed by the action of insulin on the body and on the fat cells.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, in fact, I now am remembering you'd brought that up when you talked about the type 2 diabetic taking insulin, how they gain weight. Insulin basically has a chokehold on fat cells. It is the master of what fat cells are doing. Not only directly within the fat cell, insulin is exquisitely capable of preventing a fat cell from breaking down its fat, thus promoting the storage of fat in a fat cell and fostering its growth. Indeed, you cannot make a fat cell grow unless insulin is elevated. It is absolutely impossible. It cannot happen. Insulin has to be elevated for a fat cell to grow. Otherwise, it will shrink. There's just no getting around that idea. Now, when we take that idea to the whole human, because I'm talking about it from the level, you know, the isolated cell, when we look at the fat tissue and the fat cells in the context of the whole organism, of course, calorie number matters. And I'm not saying it doesn't, but insulin matters as well, because insulin changes calories. It changes what the body does with energy. That's what a calorie is, of course. Uh-huh. And you kind of presented this idea well. We know that when insulin is elevated, metabolic rate is slowed. And thus, this whole idea of, you know, people invoking this dogmatic statement of calories in, calories out, and that's just understanding that is the key to obesity. I don't disagree with that. I mean, it's sort of that kind of idea you can't disagree with. Energy has to be accounted for. But I also think it lends itself to a very naive, if not harmful, view of human obesity, which is that you simply need to count every calorie, and every calorie you put in your body, you assume that every calorie is going to have the exact same effect on the body, and then you have to balance that with this impossible estimate of every calorie going out. In other words, how much energy you're actually expending. The average, it's impossible to know what someone's metabolic rate is, you know, day in and day out. And that view, as if every calorie that coming in has the exact same energetic effect on the body, is absolutely false, because we have to consider what those calories do to hormones, especially insulin. Because insulin in particular, and other hormones have influences on metabolic function as well, but insulin is just such a king in this regard, or queen. Insulin tells the body what to do with energy. It tells the body when to store energy. It tells the body when to break down energy. And then at the whole level of the body, it dictates how high or low the engine, the metabolic engine, is idling. And when insulin is elevated, the idle slows, because insulin is so determined to tell the body to store energy. That's one of its kind of thematic effects throughout the entire body. Insulin wants the body to store energy, and it can do that better by lowering the metabolic rate, so the body is using less energy so it can store more. In contrast, when insulin is down, the body has no choice but to use more energy, and metabolic rate will go up, and this can be a pretty significant swing. My friend and colleague David Ludwig at Harvard published a paper on this. He found that when you would manipulate someone's insulin levels throughout the day by manipulating the carbohydrate to fat ratio in the diet, because carbohydrates spike insulin and fats don't, then he found that he could alter the metabolic rate in people by almost 300 calories per day.
Wow.
Well, that's a pretty significant amount.
Yeah, that is.
That's an hour or two on the stair stepper, to me, is to say an hour of pure hell. But it's something that people just don't appreciate, that they will look at a food that has 100 calories of this, 100 calories of that, and they'll think it's all the same. It isn't the same, because what those calories do to insulin will in part dictate what the body does with that energy coming in.
So a Snicker bar diet is not going to be beneficial, even though your calories are
No.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I remember I was in school in my nutrition classes. This is many years ago at USC, which is now a very important nutritional research center. And the doctor was, it was our nutrition course, and he said beer and pretzels were the same. If the calories were the same, they had the same amount of effect on the body, which at that point I got up and walked out, and he was very offended. But you know, there was... what? There was
good for you.
Yeah, there was a visual that you said. I saw one of your lectures, and it was so powerful to me. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that insulin resistance is a survival mechanism, in that the insulin is attempting, because insulin puts fat into cells, as well as many other functions, but it's the cells have enough fat. They don't need any more. And so they're blocking the entrance or the ability of insulin to push more fat into the cells. So in actuality, it's some form of survival mechanism for the body to get to the point of insulin resistance after it's been so out of balance for so long.
Yes, that's right. So you're bringing up a wonderful point, and it's now kind of touching on the origins of insulin resistance. And this is a very much actively explored area, so I wouldn't want anyone to think I'm speaking with absolute authority here, but I will speak with informed speculation. I believe the evidence suggests that insulin resistance starts at the fat cells themselves. And that doesn't just mean, oh, someone is obviously fatter than healthy, and so they are obviously insulin resistant. It's not that simple, unfortunately. What I've seen described in various manuscripts, and I like this description, is something referred to as a personal fat threshold, where some bodies are incapable of storing very much fat. They have a very low threshold, and other bodies have a very high threshold. They can store a much higher level of fat and stay, you know, metabolically healthier despite that fat. And that's really dependent on the nature or the way the fat cells are growing, or someone's fat tissue. So if we have someone who's gaining weight, they are gaining weight. One person will be gaining weight through, or I'll say it this way, we have two different ways. If our fat tissue is getting bigger, we have more to pinch and more to jiggle. It can be growing through two different mechanisms. One is that the number of fat cells is expanding. So we used to have 100 fat cells in one area, and now we have 200. But each individual fat cell is staying at a pretty modest size. It's just, it starts to grow a little bit, and then we just recruit a new fat cell to come into the area to help continue to store the energy. And that is a type of fat growth called hyperplasia. So it's basically as if we have a hotel, and the moment we reach full occupancy, we just add more
another
hotels.
Room.
And so this is that's right. We just keep adding more rooms to the hotel, so we always have room for more. So in other words, vacancy. There's always vacancy. In contrast, and this is the more predominant method of fat growth, we have a finite number of fat cells, and each individual fat cell is forced to store an ever-growing amount of fat. Each individual fat cell is getting very, very fat on its own, and that's a type of fat growth called hypertrophy. And again, this is how most people gain weight. And so it's like the analogy of the hotel. We just keep shoving more and more guests into each hotel room when eventually we literally can't shove any more guests into the hotel room. And now this, if we go back to the fat cell knows it has reached a point of maximum dimension. It physically can't get bigger. And so if insulin continues to tell it to get bigger, it will damage the cell, and the cell will burst. It can't get any bigger. So now the fat cell, knowing this, will basically tell insulin, when insulin is coming and demanding that it store more fat. In the fat cell will say to insulin, I'm as big as I can get. If I get any bigger, I will burst, and that will become very dangerous for the body. So forget you. I'm not going to listen to you anymore. And what happens is the fat cell becomes insulin resistant, and now it starts leaking fat. And so we just sort of reach a point of stasis, if you will, where the fat cell just it gets to a size and stops, and it does so by becoming insulin resistant. And then that fat cell is leaking these fats, also leaking things called cytokines, which are pro-inflammatory proteins. Uh-huh. So the combination of that heightened inflammation and all of those free fatty acids circulating through the blood starts to spill the insulin resistance throughout the body. So it's basically like we have a stack of dominoes. The fat cell falls first. That's the first domino, and then it starts spilling into the other tissues like mm-hmm. muscle and brain and liver and gonads, et cetera.
What are some tips for our audience to use to help control insulin? Corinne referred to this earlier. What are our best tools to make sure that our insulin stays sensitive?
Yes. The best way, without a doubt, is controlling glucose coming in. We can lower the glucose. We can lower the glucose coming in, then the insulin has no choice but to start coming down because the blood sugars have no choice but to start coming down. But that is such an important paradigm. It seems so obvious. And it's interesting because we have drugs that we will give patients that will block the amount of glucose that can be absorbed from the diet. And then they can eat their starchy bagel and take these pills, and it makes the glucose just stay in the gut. Alternatively, we can give them a drug that forces the glucose out of the blood by pushing it out through the kidneys into the urine. And there's something just so rational to look at this. Uh-huh. Because we say, okay, we can give you a drug that blocks the glucose coming in, and unfortunately you'll get horrific flatulence and diarrhea. But you know, so what? We can block the glucose coming in, or alternatively, or at the same time, we can push the glucose out through your urinary tract, and yes, you'll have significantly higher risk. You'll get much more frequent urinary tract infections because we're feeding all the bacteria with all that glucose, and you might even have a higher risk of bladder cancer. But you know what? That's just what we got to do to control your blood sugar. And then the rational individual is looking at this thinking,
and say,
why don't I just eat less carbohydrate?
Exactly.
That is what it all comes down to. If someone wants to lower their insulin, and I think that is what they should, without a doubt, the best way of doing that is controlling your carbohydrates. Now, I'm not saying don't eat any, but you just got to get smarter about the starches and the sugars, and that's the key.
Now, I want to throw something in here. This will just shake this whole conversation all up. ketones, how do they relate mm-hmm. to insulin, and what are ketones? Are they something we have to watch out for and be worried about if we see them or if we have them? They have been a dirty word for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they sure have. Ketones for a long time were considered metabolic garbage, quote unquote.
Exactly.
They were considered so meaningless in the body. In fact, beyond meaningless, they were looked at as just purely villains. Which is deeply unfortunate. In the case of untreated type 1 diabetes, then they are something to be worried about. But for everyone else, they're not something to be worried about. In fact, they're perhaps to a degree something to be embraced. So a ketone is, for lack of a better description, a piece of burned fat. Now, that might sound like a bad mm-hmm. thing. So when insulin is low, as I mentioned earlier, the body has no choice but to burn fat, even to the point that it's burning more fat than it actually needs to burn. So, you know, typically a body only wants to use nutrients like carbohydrate or fat, glucose or fat, based on how much energy the body needs. You know, it's sort of matched. I need this much energy, and so I'm going to burn this much nutrient to get that much energy. Mm-hmm. But when insulin is low, the body can't help but continue to just break, to be burning energy, especially fat, even though it doesn't need that much. And so you look at the body where insulin is low, it's burning more fat than it actually needs because it can't help itself. That extra, whatever it is beyond what the energy the body needs, gets converted into ketones. Yes, an overly simplified description, but basically you're making ketones from burned fat where you just are burning more fat than you need to burn. And so a ketone is literally coming from a fat molecule that has been, you know, what we say burned, where it's been split apart, ready to be, you know, ready for its sort of final step of burning to give the body energy. It will convert some of these molecules into ketones. And ketones are a nutrient in their own right. They have a caloric value. Any cell with mitochondria will take in ketones and very, very happily use ketones for fuel. And in fact, the brain is more than happy to use ketones. The little evidence we do have suggests that the brain actually prefers ketones as a fuel over glucose levels. There's a tremendous myth about brain energy use, that the brain can only use glucose. That is absolute myth. The brain, when someone is fasting or they're in a state of ketosis, which means their ketones are higher than normal, the brain can be getting up to 70% of all of its caloric needs from ketones. So the ketones start to very much displace the glucose use in the brain. And the nice thing about that is the brain doesn't need to rely on insulin to tell it to use ketones. If ketones are up, the ketones just go right in and get used. And one of the fundamental defects in Alzheimer's disease is that the brain can't use glucose very well anymore. And so thank heavens that we have this alternative fuel, ketones, ready to go and ready to provide that alternative fuel. Unfortunately, most people never have any ketones because they're
snacking all day
with their insulin levels.
Wow.
That's right. Yeah. And it's because we follow the advice we've been told. We've been told to eat high carbohydrate diets, and it's better to have six small meals a day.
Exactly.
Than three, or heaven forbid, two or one. So someone wakes up in the morning, finally overnight, their insulin has come down. They may be in a mild state of ketosis, which is a perfectly healthy state, where their ketones are a little elevated. And what does the average person do? They immediately slam shut the fat burning. They ram their ketones down to zero by spiking their insulin up with a starchy, sugary breakfast of bagels and orange juice and cereal and all kinds of garbage. And then they do that again 2 or 3 hours later, and again 2 hours later. And so every waking moment in the average American is spent in a state of elevated insulin, and it is entirely dependent on their diet. The food we eat is either the culprit or the cure, and in many instances, it's only the culprit. It is what's causing the problem. And unfortunately, we just have to, not even dramatically, we just have to change the way we eat, change the way we look at food and how frequently we're eating in order for food to suddenly become part of the cure.
We've gone from eating breakfast with eggs and meats and cheeses and vegetables to this whole grocery aisle of cereals.
Kellogg. Yeah.
Whoever convinced us that
Kellogg
cereals are a good breakfast, and we particularly impose these on our children.
Kellogg started the breakfast. No, seriously.
Yep.
He started breakfast cereals to reduce aggressive sexual activity in males.
Yep. Yes. And you know what? I would say it's worked.
I think so also.
As you feed men diets consisting of nothing but junk cereal and breads and crackers, they will absolutely gain more weight. And as a man gets fatter, his fat cells start to act a little bit like ovaries. That's a whole other topic, I know. But it will, in fact, lower his testosterone and make him less fertile. So in a way, I would think doctor, I use that term very loosely, Kellogg, I think would be quite happy with the outcome. Because you feed a man a bunch of junk, we know that men who adhere to vegetarian diets do, in fact, have lower sperm counts. So there may be something to his theory.
Can you?
I think so. What about prostate enlargement. Here's another epidemic, and you've mm-hmm. also linked that to insulin resistance. And I would say that the general public has no concept of this, nothing.
Yes. Yes. So insulin, I mentioned earlier that one of insulin's thematic effects throughout the body is to tell the body to store energy. A part of that is encompassed in this idea that it also tells things to grow. It tells cells to grow. Now, that, of course, is essential. And so thank heavens we have something like insulin. So I never want anyone to think I'm only painting insulin as the villain. Not at all. It has unfortunately become the villain in many instances. But we need insulin. It tells cells to grow, including cells of the prostate. And so at a normal level of insulin, the growth signal from insulin is very, very modest, and it would be countered by other hormones and other signals telling the prostate cells to not grow. And so there would be a yin and a yang, or a balance of these signals. But when someone has insulin resistance, one of the something I've been alluding to throughout our conversation is that insulin resistance is a state where it's a state of two phenomena. On one hand, insulin isn't working the same way at all cells of the body like it used to. That's the insulin resistance part of it. But the unspoken part is that blood insulin levels are chronically elevated, a condition called hyperinsulinemia. And we touched on elevated insulin being a marker of insulin resistance, and it's more than a marker. It is, in fact, an essential component. Insulin resistance is a coin with two sides. One is the altered effect of insulin at certain cells, and the other side is the chronically elevated insulin. Now, when we look at this as applied to the prostate is simply suffering in large part from the effects of the chronically elevated insulin. Insulin continues to tell those prostate cells to grow, just like it's telling those hypertrophic fat cells to grow. And so we have a prostate that's getting enlarged. And in fact, it is incredibly uncommon for someone to be diagnosed with even benign prostatic enlargement or hypertrophy, so not to the point of cancer, but to the point that this is a guy who
swelling.
Can't urinate as freely mm-hmm. as he could before,
right.
and it's uncomfortable. It is almost certainly the case that he simply has not been diagnosed with insulin resistance yet, but it is almost certainly there and contributing to the problem.
We had an amazing interview last week with that we were talking about stem cells and about genetics and everything, and the doctor there said something very powerful, and Dr. Kathleen O'Neill Smith of Boston, and she said, you know, 87% of our genetic expression has to do with our environment, environmental factors. And I said, wow, what does that do? That gives us back our responsibility. What you are also saying, that we can create these changes, we, us, within our life, within our lifestyle, and that gives us back our responsibility. It's a very powerful statement
yes.
that you're saying. Now, I wanted to say something, and you could laugh or you could listen, whichever is appropriate, but I've heard of Alzheimer's called type 3 diabetes. Is that an over-exaggeration, or are we really looking at a syndrome that has to be explored more deeply?
Yes, wonderful, wonderful. I'm happy to answer that question. In fact, even with some data of my own from my own lab, with regards to diet and the power that comes from that, I want to echo your comment, where it is a powerful realization, and in fact, it's very much, again, another reason why I'm so passionate about this. I love the idea of someone realizing that they can do more than just take a pill that will never actually solve the problem. Because the moment we start using medication to try to solve insulin resistance or any of these problems that are derivative from insulin resistance, you will never do anything but continue to take more and more of that medication, and it will never solve the problem. It will only be addressing symptoms of the problem. However, unfortunately, some people don't want that. They don't want to take that responsibility on themselves. Honest to goodness, some people would rather take a pill than go through the discomfort of changing their habits. Now, With regards to Alzheimer's disease, we in fact just published a very high-profile manuscript where we had access to brain samples from human donors. And these are people, we had two groups. We had people who died that donated their brains, that people who died without Alzheimer's disease and people who died with Alzheimer's disease. Uh-huh. So it presented a very powerful tool for us. And we looked at the expression of genes involved in metabolism. And we found, especially in the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain involved in memory and learning, the people with Alzheimer's disease had virtually universal reductions in every single gene involved in glucose metabolism. This included pulling in glucose, so glucose uptake, and the actual breakdown or the burning of the glucose for energy in the brain. Every one of those glucose-related genes was significantly down. And then we compared with the brains of people who did not have Alzheimer's disease. In contrast, when we looked at the genes involved in ketone metabolism, there were a couple genes of the roughly 20 or so that were down, but then all the rest of them were totally normal. And so this is, and those glucose-related genes are under the thumb of insulin. If insulin is working at these hippocampal brain cells, then insulin can induce the expression of these genes. It's almost like insulin will tell a cell to express the genes to build all the necessary hardware in order for the glucose to be burned. So insulin wants to help a cell use glucose as a fuel. But as these brain cells become insulin resistant, they don't, among many other problems, they don't express these glucose metabolism genes as well as they did before. And this was a very, very strong finding, very consistent, very, very statistically significant. And then to bring this to what you'd mentioned, invoking type 3 diabetes, that term type 3 diabetes is one I don't love just because I think it kind of confuses the issue. What I would rather we refer to this as is insulin resistance of the brain, which in a way is simply a progression of type 2 diabetes in one way or another, because type 2 diabetes is insulin resistance. So that, I think, encompasses the insulin resistance of any of the tissues, including Alzheimer's disease. It just may be happening before the person's blood glucose levels are significantly up. So it may be happening before the person is diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. But the correlational evidence now combined more and more with mechanistic or basic research evidence is so compelling that I am incredibly optimistic that the more we view Alzheimer's disease as a metabolic problem, the better we are going to prevent it and the better we are treating it. Already, you can do no more than take a patient with Alzheimer's disease and put them into ketosis, and they will immediately have a more significant improvement in their memory and learning than any drug available for Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
And there are studies, including clinical studies in humans, that confirm these findings. The best available drugs trying to address all of the kind of classic, the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, the plaques or the nerve tangles, the drugs don't do a darn thing at actually working. It's just one failed drug after another. And then it's almost like nature is just waiting for it to be leveraged as a tool here. Put the person in ketosis. You overcome this energy gap where the brain can't get enough energy from glucose. And so, thank heavens, we step in and give it energy from ketones. And now things suddenly start to get better. Now, a note of caution. I'm not saying that the ketones totally cure the Alzheimer's. No, that does not happen. The best evidence suggests it simply helps, where their memory is a little better, their function and cognition is a little better. And so I would think more the power of ketones in Alzheimer's disease, and I would say by a broader extension, controlling insulin resistance, is to come in prevention. It is, you keep your body insulin sensitive, let your brain have some ketones from time to time, and now you're going to be doing what you can to keep Alzheimer's at bay.
This is absolutely amazing. Carol, I need to be a little rude because guess what?
Oh, no.
Honest. Time flies when we're so involved in having fun. I got a page of questions in front of me. I wanted to explain the two types of fat and how some can be utilized to lose it. I had so much to talk about.
That'll be part two.
How can we monitor insulin at home is my question. Is that on the horizon or anything available now?
I think we will have at-home insulin tests within the next couple years. Where you can do a little finger prick and get a little bit of blood, and it'll give you an idea of your insulin.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Continuous insulin monitors, I'd say, is more 10 years out.
Wow.
But what someone could do right now, there are things called ketone meters right now, where just like a glucose meter, where you prick your finger and put a little dipstick against that drop of blood and get your level of ketone. Mm-hmm. If someone has ketones that are detectable, that would suggest insulin is low. Now, I can't give a specific number to that, but ketones do represent a bit of an inverse indicator of insulin and thus may have a kind of at-home value. So if someone wakes up in the morning, they measure their ketones and they see that their ketones are kind of online, so to speak, that the little machine can measure them at all, that's a good sign that your insulin is low.
Thank you so very much. That, to end with that little pearl is wonderful. Will that work with urine ketone sticks?
Yep.
Okay. Yep, and they're cheap and readily available. I want to thank you, Dr. Beckman and Benjamin. And now I know why you're such a wonderful professor and teacher. But I want to thank you so much. You've really helped us understand. So I'm going to rush this, Carol. I want to say thank you, Carol. Dr. Beckman, can you give us your website?
Yes. Thank you again so much. I'm moderately active on social media, mostly Instagram. People can find me there at Ben Beckman, PhD. And I regularly contribute blog and video content to a website called Get Health. And health is, we're being a little clever there. It's spelled HLTH, gethealth.com.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so much. And we're going to say see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we'll be back next week. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Remember, this information is not an attempt to diagnose or a substitute for treatment. As always, we urge you to take this and all other information we share with you up with your healthcare practitioner. Clearly, this comes under the category of taking charge of your health. You can hear this program in its entirety on my Facebook, Corinne Fornari, RPA CCN, or on Take Charge of Your Health Facebook page, Take Charge of Your Health. My website is fornarihealth.com. And my office number is 212-219-0700. That's 212-219-0700. And I know many of you noticed that beautiful music, a big change. My brother's group wrote it for me. Left Hook from Redding, California. Really special. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.